I'd like to welcome everyone. And this is the first thing on the 10-day Council of the Living Arms, where we're going to be exploring different geomantic traditions from Europe, from the Orient, from the Americas, the scientific traditions, and go into both theoretical and experiential applications of this knowledge. And we have assembled an outstanding faculty from many different places around the country and around the world. So we're very honored to have this faculty here. This is the beginning of a public weekend, and I'll go into that in just a minute. I'd like to say a few things about the Montesics and also the foundation. The foundation is a nonprofit educational center, and there's also a community that lives here. And this kind of gathering is the kind of thing that we like to put on, where we bring teachers from many different traditions together, where they can meet each other and have some open exchange of ideas, and so that there's some coming together of the many different traditions that this time calls for. And we've been involved for many years in very important work doing geomantic research and in exploring the traditions of Europe in an extensive way. Over here we have Nigel Pennock, who's been doing very important work in geomancy for many years and is a leading researcher in the field. This is Paul Devereaux, who wrote the book Earth Lights and is one of the co-founders of the Dragon Project. And this is John Steele, also one of the co-founders of the Dragon Project. And they have a tremendous amount of information to share here, so I'm going to stop blabbing and turn it over to them and say that we're very pleased to have them with us.
Great. Thank you, Robin. The title of what I want to speak to you about this morning is Geomantic Amnesia. It's fitting that after we have Mr. Shah opening our minds last night on the concept of geomancy, yeah, we might take a look at some of the more subtle and metaphysical dimensions of what geomancy is about. I should say that, first of all, just my own background so you know who's talking to you. I have training in archaeology, and I also have training I'm working on a doctorate in psychology on the subject of memory. And I used to think this is a pretty disparate bunch of things, archaeology and psychology, until I came across the curious fact that both Freud and Jung, their first love was archaeology. And in fact, Jung said that he looked at psychoanalysis as an archaeology of the psyche. So it became very appropriate for me to wed together these two kind of ways of looking at things. And so I've kind of come up with what I might call a psychological archaeology, which is a little bit different than just object-based archaeology. In fact, we might call it somewhat akin to, we have the new physics and new biology. What we're involved in is something akin to what we might call a new archaeology. It's much more, it's like archaeology plus the component of mind. Now, what I would like to start off with in giving you an overview of geomancy in this particular age that we live in is the temporal context in which we live. In Eastern Indian chronology, they talk about four great yugas, or cycles of time, in every great cycle of time, which is called a Mahayuga. Yuga means cycle of time. So in each cycle of time, there are four yugas. The first is the Sat Yuga, which is the golden age where everyone is healthy and fine and marriages don't break up and there's no income tax and things like that. Okay. Progressively, you get a kind of entropic fall. You get a silver age where you get the first bits of marital discord, etc. And then you get to the bronze age where marriage counselors come in. And finally, you get to the age that we live in today, which is the Kali Yuga. I want to spend a few minutes kind of setting the stage for this. The Kali Yuga is it's the shortest of the yugas. It's only 432,000 years, so nothing to get too excited about. But the fact is there's a lot of differences about the exact temporal duration of this age, and that's not so important. What is important is symbolically what it has to say to us. So that's what I want to take a look at now. First of all, Kali is the goddess of time. She's also the goddess of dissolution of structures. Kali also means iron age. It also means dark ages. Now, in Tibetan, the translation for Kali Yuga is very, very interesting and instructive. It means the dregs of time. The dregs of time. Now let's take a look at what that might mean. The dregs is the bottom of a fermenting barrel of liquor. It's the bitterest, murkiest, densest bit of a fermenting liquor. So the dregs it's heavy stuff. It's the bottom of the barrel. So we are living in that age, which is the bottom of the barrel of time. Now, what does that translate to in terms of a 20th century life? It translates to the following. It means that we have a very high density of time that we're living in, a temporal density. Now, again, what does that mean? It means, quite simply, that in the 20th century, we're living in an age when we have too many events per unit of time to process fully. Okay? Now, everyone knows what that means. It means you got to pay the bills. You got to walk the dog, you got to go to the doctor, you got to pay the income tax, and the in-laws are coming over, and the kids got it, and then this, and it's endless. It's absolutely endless. I find myself writing lists about lists about lists about what I have to do, and then the lists get thrown out. Okay, so the first thing is this density of time, too many events per unit of time. Okay, the second thing that and a lot of people can't handle that. They're the ones who go bananas and end up in the mental institutions. They just cannot handle the information overload. It hits the rest of us in very mundane ways. For example, you begin in the kitchen and you say, okay, and you end up in the bedroom and you say, now, why did I come into the bedroom? Everyone knows that feeling now. You kind of sit there and you say, why have I come into this room? And the point is that you have such an information overload that by the time you've gone to 50 or 100 feet, that you're processing so much that you've even forgot the reason why you were going to get there. Another aspect of the Kali Yuga is because there's so many events per unit of time, you get the semblance or the feeling that everything is going faster because there are more events. Everything is going faster and faster and faster. Where did that week go? Where did that month go? Where did that year go? Just completely gone. Because the events are happening so fast. You look at the headlines and they're just like that. Life then begins to take the appearance of a dream. You feel as though things are happening to you rather than you consciously constructing a life quite often. Another aspect on a larger scale is what we get what we call in systems terms a runaway systems. That is to say, everything, this temporal density accretes to such a point where things get out of control. Seats of government, many people, the Reagans, the Gorbachevs, you get people in power, but it almost doesn't matter what their names are anymore. You are dealing with a system which is pretty much out of control. And this is ironic because control is the valued manipulative strategy for political systems, and they can't even hold on to what they want to the most. Okay, so that's a little bit of an introduction to the age in which we live in. This Kali Yuga, and I'm bringing this into because the idea of geomantic amnesia springs from this tremendous kind of information overload where we can't keep, as it were, in mind the most important aspects of life, and we'll get to that in a moment. When I was studying at Berkeley many years ago, I was studying English literature at the time, and my professor was explaining to me the mysteries of King Lear, which I'm sure at least most of you are somewhat familiar with. King Lear gets chucked out of his kingdom by his three daughters, and he realizes that the only daughter, Cordelia, who is his true friend, he's done her in. And he's up on a hill. It's called the Heath Scene, and he invokes the storm, and he says, blow, winds, rage, crack your cheeks. And he invokes a storm because his mind is so turbulent over him blowing his kingdom. And at this point, my professor said, well, this is just a case of what we call the pathetic fallacy. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, it's a fallacy that there's any relationship between the mind of man and nature. Yeah. And I said, well, gee, that just doesn't sound right to me. I didn't know about geomancy at that point, but it just intuitively didn't sound right. He said, it's just a literary device. So that was the point at which got me to question all of this geomantic amnesia, as it were. Because the pathetic fallacy is a pathetic fallacy. It just depends how you look at it. Now, we all know time and time again about, we've gone over this idea how Newtonian physics has kind of sunk the old world view of direct intuition and direct perception of nature. I won't dwell on that too long. I'll just quote one thing from Lyle Watson in Lightning Bird. He said, "It is no longer possible to deny that our thoughts and desires might influence our environment. The most recent cosmologies all include consciousness as an active participating factor in reality. The new explanations of how the world works are strangely like the old beliefs of non-literate people everywhere. It seems that merely by admitting the possibility of unlikely events, you increase the probability of their occurrence." In other words, just by admitting the possibility that strangeness could occur, strangeness then says, okay, thank you very much, I'll come. Because we live in a reflective universe, a reciprocal universe, not a one-way mirror of us to nature or nature to us. It's a complete reciprocal flow. It's interesting, from the Hopi tradition, they tell us a very interesting myth which reflects on this idea of geomantic amnesia. They say, in fact, instead of, they talk about kyanaskatsi, which means roughly the same thing. It means life out of balance or crazy life. And it means roughly the same thing as Kali Yuga. It's a pretty good analogy to the East Indian term. And they say, "Our divergence from the natural balance is traced to a point preceding existence of our present physical form. Once we were able to appear and disappear at will, but through our own arrogance we took our procreative powers for granted and neglected the plan of the Creator. As a consequence, we became stuck in our physical form, dominated by a continual struggle between our left and right sides. The left being wise but clumsy." Okay, now left corresponds to right brain. "Wise but clumsy. And the right being clever and powerful, but unwise and forgetful of our original purpose." Right side, left brain. Okay? So they had all this split brain stuff down a long time before Roger Sperry and company did. And basically, what they're saying is that the wise but clumsy side, that is our right brain intuitive dimension, got a bit, it was overridden by the clever but powerful left brain side, which was so clever that it forgot its original purpose, its connection with the Creator. And this is what we're talking about in geomantic amnesia, is this forgetting of source and forgetting of origin, forgetting of where we have come from, forgetting of our total interrelationship with an ecological network. Now, in esoteric systems, and my focus on my doctoral thesis is looking at esoteric memory systems in the perennial philosophy, looking at memory within the context of meditative systems, looking at in the context of altered state stuff, shamanism, etc. Now, all esoteric traditions have the concept of a fall, just like in this Hopi tradition. The fall always takes the place that people fall from a source, from an origin, from a godhead, whatever you want to call it, and they become hypnotized by the external world. They become hypnotized particularly by objects and by the interactions and relationships of objects. In fact, the biggest industry in the world today is record keeping. Computers are basically, more than anything else, they function as record keeping machines. Now, in the earliest records found, the first record ever found, the Sumerian tablet, the first writing ever found, about 4500 BC, is a tax receipt. It's nothing esoteric whatsoever. Okay? The interesting things is that subsequent record-keeping stuff on and some previous things as well, a bit more primitive, were tally sticks. I have this many cows, you have this many sheep, etc., etc. And what began to happen is people began to keep records of the objects and then the interrelation of objects and the transactions between objects. And thus, a different type of memory began to accrete, a left-brain memory, an object-based memory began to accrete. A right brain type of memory has nothing to do with the storage of discrete bits of information. A right brain type of memory has to do with the stillness of the mind to the point where a higher order of consciousness, call it the over-self, call it God, call it whatever you want, will come in through the channel in which you open by your stillness and give you information on a right way of life. All you have to do is find the still point. And the memory comes to you. The Greek term for this, anamnesis, means the memory which comes again, or the memory which is of a divine origin, of the total cycle of pre-existence. But this only comes when you are still. our left brain memory in the 20th century is based on accumulation of discrete bits of information with the tacit assumption that more is better. The more memory we have, the better. The more storage capacity your computer has, the stronger, the more macho it's considered to be. So all I'm saying is that more is not necessarily better. Because here we are in the 20th century, we've got greater storage capacity than ever before on the planet. And yet we take a look at the world and it's a complete runaway system. I mean, at least on the political level. So more is better is not a very viable philosophy. Okay, now, with this idea of a left brain type of memory, it's always accreting more, and a right one is sitting still and being a recipient from a higher order of memory. Let's take a look at some other aspects of geomantic amnesia. First of all, sacred places. What are sacred places and how do they function? A sacred place, from the point of view of memory, it was very good that Professor Shah last night, I was very pleased to see him stressing the idea that sacred places were places where you learned to cultivate your meditation, to cultivate your sense of stillness, to cultivate your direct connection to Gaia, to the earth. Now, this is what a sacred place is. And in terms of memory, a sacred place is where you remember to remember. Okay? It's very simply put, you remember to remember. And in the esoteric framework of esoteric memory, we call this double remembrance. You remember to remember. You remember to remember to wake up. You remember to remember to that you are part of this vast network of being, that you are not just an isolated ego, that you have a sense of total connectivity to your environment. So the double remembrance then is augmented by being in a sacred place. Sure, you can, if you are a master, double remembrance can occur anywhere. But sacred places are places which will augment, which will just give that little bit more of an impetus to double remembrance. And when we talk about, later on, when Paul and I and Nigel, we talk about the Dragon Project and sacred places, we'll give some of the mechanics and dynamics of what goes on scientifically at sacred places. Now, at these sacred places, in addition, let's contrast the idea of double remembrance to the idea of double forgetting. This is the exact opposite. Double forgetting means that you forget something, and then, this is tricky, you forget that you forgot. Okay? Most of the time we forget, and then you can wake up later and say, oh, gee, I forgot that, and then you remember it again. But double forgetting is so deep, it's so primary, that once you forget something, then you forget that you forgot it, and you proceed as if that is a normal state. And, for example, since the scientific revolution in the 1600s and so, that's what we're dealing with, is a large-scale network of double forgetting in terms of being linked to a total Earth, a total kind of Gaia field, a total kind of integrity. So the Kali Yuga, then, is an age in which double forgetting predominates. And the interesting thing, though, about this is that for many, many people, I mean, people such as, again, are gathered in these type of meetings, there's always just a tiny seed left of this double remembrance, just a tiny seed, and it is actually stimulated by the degree to which the double forgetting becomes almost predominating. And it's like in the yin-yang symbol, in the white there's a drop of the black, and in the black there's a drop of the white. It means right at the extreme, right when you're about to totally lose it, there is some shard left of remembrance that some people hold on to. And that's the spark that keeps this planet going at this point. It's just that there is some shard of remembrance, even at the darkest times. I should say about the Kali Yuga before I go on, I always paint it pretty dark to begin with, is that although it is very dark in a runaway system and we can blow ourselves off the planet at any time, conversely, all the great teachers say it is the best time to do any form of spiritual practice, because in the darkest room, a smallest candle makes a very bright light. It's what Don Juan calls in his works a worthy opponent. I don't know if you all recall this idea. It was when Don Juan set up someone almost like against Carlos, thought that he was going to kill him. but it was all a setup to make him do his very, very best. Same with the Kali Yuga. It's like a tremendous worthy opponent, and it makes us go right to the line. There's no room for fudge factors in this age. You've got to do your very, very best. Okay, now, one of the things that is lost in terms of the Kali Yuga, one of the things that we forget in terms of this dregs of time, is the concept of present time. Now, present time with a capital P. Okay, it's not. I'm not just talking about that little slice of time between past, present, and future. I'm talking about present time in a metaphysical sense, in the sense of the perennial philosophy, now with capital letters, N-O-W. This sense of present time is, present time is a gateway to all altered states of consciousness. When you are still, you enter present time, and that acts as a gateway to any type of an altered state, whether it's meditative, contemplative, devotional, it doesn't matter. Present time is a gateway. And in the Kali Yuga, because of this density of time, we do not utilize that gateway. We get hung up on this immense flow of events going bam, 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 and we're hung up on the events rather than the space between the events or the space between thoughts. All the meditative traditions stress that it's the space between the thoughts where meditation can begin. Between the thoughts is where it can begin. So present time is this gateway. Now, present time deals with being, capital B, E-I-N-G. Instead of knowledge, it's a being state. And it deals with simultaneity, and it deals with connectivity of all life and all beings. It deals with what Gregory Bateson and the anthropologist called the pattern that connects. What we have got to in the 20th century is tremendous fragmentation of knowledge. And present time is total connectivity. When you truly sit in meditation and you're still, you realize that there is no difference between yourself and your environment, that you are totally connected. It's only when the ego comes back into the mind that this sense of fragmentation gets very, very big and very, very potent. Okay, the present time in other cultures, it's like the dream time in the Aboriginal sense, Australian Aboriginal sense. The idea of entering the dream time is like entering the first time. Now, why do I mention this idea of present time at this time? Because when we are at sacred sites, one of the things that we do, at least on one level, I've just drawn a diagram here. At sacred sites, for example, they all deal in stone circles I'm talking at in particular, the tradition that the three of us have been working at in the British Isles. They will have certain stones, and we'll show slides of these things later on in the day, certain stones at certain points in the circle at which the sun will rise over the solstice points, June 21st, December 21st, and the two corresponding equinox points. And there will also be oftentimes cross-quarter days, what we call Lammas and Candlelammas and Martinmas, etc. They are points which have to do with the evolution of the year. Just like in the evolution of a human life, there is an evolution of the year. The solstices and the equinoxes, etc., denote certain growth points of light and darkness throughout the year. And one thing that a sacred site does is it'll have a stone here, here, and here, and the sun will rise over it, and you will be able to orient yourself in time exactly where you are in the cosmic year. Now, that is one function, that is a surface function of what sacred sites do. Beneath that, there is another function. Underneath this kind of evolutionary cycle of the year is something which we will call the great. Now, this is really a Taoist term. And the great is, in a sense, is the mother of yin and yang. It is the mother of all, even the most primary of dualities. Yin and yang is born of the great. You can call it, if you want, you can call it God, you can call it the Dharmakaya. In the Tibetan tradition, you can call it the ground consciousness, but I like the term the great very much, and considering we just had a talk last night on geomancy, which deals with yin and yang, etc., it's quite appropriate. The great, then, is the mother of even the most primary of dualities. And underneath every one of these points, as well as being a point in the evolution of the year, is a gateway down to the great. And what that means is that you can contact the great, the source of even the most primary of dualities, by at each one of these gateways. You can go down to the great. You can use it as a contact point. Now, many times people just get hung up on this is the equinox and this is the solstice and we plant now and we... That's wonderful. But you must also realize that each one of these turning points of the year is also a gateway to the great, to present time. That's what I mean by the great, the access to present time. And that access to present time gives you the inspiration of right living. It gives you the inspiration of what your tribe or your group needs at any given time. It is a reversal. Instead of you seeking for information, it is when you allow yourself to be filled by information which comes. And it only comes because you are empty. If you are not empty, it will not come. This is what they call, for example, in Zen archery. They talk about the master pulls the bow back and then they say, it shoots. You don't shoot, it shoots. It knows when to let go of the arrow. It has nothing to do with I am going to let go now. It is something larger than the self. It is a complete transpersonal base. Okay, so this is the idea of the calendrical great here. Now, this idea of geomantic amnesia, let's take a little bit of a closer view of what this is. Geomantic amnesia implies the loss of an integrity of environment. As Professor Shaw said last night, geomancy is the art of controlling one's life. Well, geomantic amnesia then would mean that your life is out of control. And many people's lives on this planet are out of control. And they are out of control for a variety of reasons. One is the hypnotic attraction of external forms. Another one is we don't know where to build anymore. Our structures are wrong. This idea of the doorways being in the wrong place, going over sleeping places, was brilliant. I mean, really practical stuff as how to construct a house. I've been teaching for 7 years in University of London School of Environmental Studies, and I teach with architects and planners, and if you were to tell them this stuff, they would look at you, what? And yet these are the people who are designing the very places where more consciousness is being misproduced all the time because of wrong living situations. The interesting thing about this attraction to objects that I'm talking about is that the more attracted that you become to external objects, it begins to generate what we call automatic kind of reactive mind. Whenever you an object becomes you become hypnotically fixed towards it, you begin to generate a lot of mental chatter about that object. Where is it? Is someone going to take it? Is it in good condition? What did I do with it? A lot of mental traces is born with every object that you become attached to. That's why the great teachers have very few objects, a begging bowl and a staff, because they don't have all that. Then they don't have all the corresponding mental chatter that goes with object-based produced memories. We tend to think that because we've got computers that they can take care of that whole load of all these traces. But the problem is that we're so omnivorous about information. You look at TV and it says, new, improved, time-saving devices, whatever it is. And what do we do with the time that we save? What do? We buy more time-saving devices, and they advertise more, and then you never get the benefit of these time-saving devices because you're always buying more of them. So the more memories that you have, more traces of these objects that you have to hold, the more that keeps you out of present time. That's why your early megalithic people and early aboriginal people are much easier to go down to the great, because they don't have all this kind of traces of memories that they have to get away from. So the memory component along with object proliferation is very, very strong. Now, opposed to geomantic amnesia is geomantic recollection. Geomantic recollection is, again, much to do with what Professor Shaw was talking about last night, is being able to build your structures in the right place, right orientation, with, and what we will talk about later, sacred geometry, sacred proportions, so that you are, all your double remembrance is augmented. Your double remembrance of the source and how you fit into a total ecological network is augmented. So what we have to set our educational processes up to is one of geomantic recollection. Right ways to build, right ways to see, right ways to sense. Okay, now another aspect of geomantic amnesia is that we tend to also wipe out our fellow life forms quite, as well as just man. The extinction level on this planet is something like five species every hour, something like that, are completely obliterated from the planet. Pure geomantic amnesia. We're cutting down our hardwood forests, as you all know, particularly the Amazon. And the Amazon is considered to be the great repository of a memory gene pool, a variety of life on Earth. And as you begin to cut down this vast kind of tract of land, which is also the lungs of a continent, you really begin to alter the entire cycles of the planet. One of the aspects I didn't mention before about the Kali Yuga is that you get tremendous weather fluctuations and disturbances in the Kali Yuga, and I think we all have seen that quite profoundly, say, in the last 10 years. Tremendous fluctuations, flooding and droughts and too much of this or too much of that, rain out of season. Everything seasonally is out of kilter. This idea of weather is really a key one. Another aspect that I want to bring in at this point is different types of ancient monuments. And when we see the photographs of them in slides, we'll be able to relate what I'm saying now. I want to talk about two types of monuments: monument type one and monument type two. First of all, let's just take the word monument for starters. Monument comes from the Latin monere, which means to remind. So monuments are structures which remind us of events which have taken place in the past. Everyone knows this intuitively, but it's nice to see that etymologically right in the root of the word. Let's take a look at what I call monument type one. Let's take something like a war memorial. A war memorial commemorates a specific event, a specific time, specific people took place in it, and it commemorates that. Okay, one time, one event. Now, a monument type two, on the other hand, commemorates a process which is good throughout time. Stone circles map equinoxes and solstices as they did 2500 BC. They're still doing it today. They're still mapping them out. They are process structures. They are not just single event fixated structures. So monument type 2s have this other ability. Now, a monument type 2 has other functions as well. I came to this realization actually when I went to Newgrange with Paul in 1980. Newgrange is a vast, vast site. It's even more impressive than Stonehenge in Ireland. Newgrange gave me a kind of a teaching there. One, when you look at an ancient site like Newgrange, it gives you some insight about the past of the builders, what type of mindset that they have. They were much more right-brained than us. They thought much more ecologically. They thought symbolically. They thought in terms of flows of sun and moon in a way which we can barely intuit today, really barely intuit. Second of all, it teaches us, it acts as a reflective matrix for us in our present day time. When we look at Newgrange, it's like a vast mirror. It makes us question, now why don't we have sacred sites like this in our time today? And what is wrong with our civilization? What did this civilization, which built this structure, have going for it, which we don't? It provokes questions about our current state. Finally, it actually then gives us an input into a future state. It provokes provoke a kind of an altered state in one to kind of thinking about the future, where we might go in the future. In other words, it might induce some type of ESP type of experience. And I think people have gone to great pyramids or sacred sites. They have a feeling that this is potential at these sites. Okay, so we have these three functions which can occur: that of looking at the past, that of looking at a matrix of the present, and that of looking at a possibility of altered states or future stroke prophetic vision. And again, geomantic amnesia pretty much wipes out the second two, maybe gives us a glimpse. The spade archaeologist may say, well, how did these people live, blah, 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 and they stick up their objects in the museum and put a little sign under it, and that's that. It's object archaeology and it's finished. But on the whole, the idea of present time and the idea of a future matrix are not incorporated. Now, another an important function which I would like to bring in at this point is sacred sites are usually places where the dimensions are very thin. It's easier to contact higher mind at these places. It's easier to contact over self. It's easier to contact one's own higher mind. Let's just say that. They are what some researchers have called window areas, where there's a window to another dimension at these places. And it's interesting, in acupuncture, there's a couple of points on the head which are called windows to the sky. And these windows, again, are gateways to other dimensions of being. And these sacred sites are also windows to other dimensions. Now, one of the things which I would like to bring in here, an important kind of concept, that I've come across in my memory work is the idea of cross-state retention. Cross-state retention. Now, what does cross-state retention mean? In its most simplest terms, it means the following. Everyone goes to sleep at night, most people dream, most people wake up in the morning, and most people can't remember their dreams. You can only remember them if they're quite vivid or exceptional. But on the whole, the dreams disappear like the foam goes out on the tide, you know, just bubbles just go off on the sand. And it is because we do not have the facility of cross-state retention. Cross-state retention means the ability to remember from one state through what is normally a veil of forgetting and to remember into an ordinary state. You wake up in the dream and most people forget. That's a very, very good one. Another one is altered states, for example, whether they're induced by dancing, singing, psychotropics, sex, anything. Most people do not have the ability to remember from one altered state to an ordinary state of consciousness. So this idea of cross-state retention, and cross-state retention is the center of all aspects of the perennial philosophy and of esoteric memory. It is really the heart of the matter, this ability to remember across these kind of normal kind of veils of amnesia. Another classic one, a real big classic one, is when we come out of the womb and we're screaming and they're shaking us upside down and saying, welcome to the 3D plane, everybody's going, what? Hey, how did I get here? I mean, you know, you're just looking around. And basically, many of the esoteric teachings say that when you're in the womb, that you have all knowledge, that you have total knowledge of yourself, of God, of the numinous world. But the deal is, in exchange for going out into the 3D world, you forget. That's part of the thing. You are sealed off. The angel of forgetfulness taps you on the forehead. Okay? But the deal is, there's always this shard left, just this little seed of this double remembrance left in you. And it is your task during your lifetime to recover what you had in that kind of original oneness. So, cross-state retention is an invaluable aspect of all the activities that would go on at sacred sites. The ability to, in fact, many of the sacred sites, particularly in Greece, they were sleep temples. The whole thing with Hippocrates, you'd come in and you'd go to sleep, and then these guys would wake you up in the middle and they'd say, what are you dreaming? And they'd write it down and then you'd go back to sleep again, and all your answers would come through sleep, just being woken up, etc., just being dealt with in that way. So they were trying to facilitate cross-state retention in that way. And there are many exercises that we can do to facilitate cross-state retention. Just as an example, the Gurdjieff system called self-remembering is all based on cross-state retention. But every one of the esoteric traditions, including American Indian ones, have a basis, a teaching of cross-state retention. So what I'm getting in all this kind of stuff, it's one thing just to look at the objects of stone circles and pyramids and this and that, but unless we have some kind of metaphysics of symbols, as opposed to linear written scripts, You can see, for example, the whole kind of Mayan and Egyptian and Chinese ideogram systems. These are all to stimulate cross-state retention, and the reason that they do that is because each one of these symbols is multi-layered and multi-leveled. It is not just one consonant and one vowel and a sound without any symbolic base to it. So that is why a hieroglyph has a wealth of information packed into it, from the symbolic, the spiritual, the mental, the physical, and it stimulates cross-state retention. So all the shamanic activity that would occur at sacred sites, at stone circles, at pyramids, would all be involved with developing ideas of cross-state retention. And oftentimes you'll find them in symbolic terms, which is quite unusual. Like, for example, I hope we'll see a slide of it later, but there's a tomb, for example, in the small isle off Brittany called Gavrini. And you go into this tomb, and it's these like patterns that look like holographic patterns, kind of moiré patterns of just lines going like this. And you look at these things, and they could be in any 20th century art gallery. There's no question whatsoever about them. But the point is, they have analogies to tree rings, to fingerprints, to the patterns. But the point is, they have analogies to tree rings, to fingerprints, to the patterns of wind on water. They have analogies. All sacred symbols stimulate analogical thought, and analogical thought is the basis of cross-state retention. And one of the manifestations of geomantic recollection is increased pattern recognition. So anything which is going to increase pattern recognition is going to contribute to cross-state retention. Now, another aspect of cross-state retention that I'd like to mention is the following, is that in terms of memory, it is said that you get your highest recall of memory proportional to the degree to which each sense can encode a memory imprint. What does this mean? It means that if you come into a room and you have a tremendous smell, you have a very unusual person there, you are given something to taste which is very unusual rugs or touch. If every one of your senses has something extraordinary to encode, your memory of that event will be much greater. Most of the time, our attention span in the 20th century just kind of slides across the world, and it never goes in deep. It never touches in deep. Of course, if you meet something extraordinary like this, you will get an extraordinarily deep imprint. But the exercises like the Gurdjieff self-remembering, for example, they take ordinary events, not the extraordinary, the things, you know, with a beautiful man or woman and the extraordinary tastes and touch. The self-remembering exercises, they say, okay, you're going along through daily life, and at this moment, at 12 o'clock, stop wherever you are, take a look right where you're sitting, for 1 minute, encode the taste, touch, smell, what you're thinking. In other words, take an ordinary moment and make it extraordinary. And the reason you make it extraordinary is because of the quality of attention in which you invest in it. Memory is a function of attention. Attention, in turn, is a function of intention. Intention is will, okay? Now, so it goes intention, attention, retention. This is the cycle. So many people complain of not having a good memory. The reason they don't have a good memory is they don't have a good attention. And they don't have a good attention because the intention is not there to connect totally to their world, their environment, or their self. So we find this kind of quality of just surface attention predominating through 20th century men. You never go to your grade school or your anything. You're never taught about attention. You're never really taught about memory except rote mnemonic memory. You are not taught any types of magical or transformative memory whatsoever. Now, just a few more things to share with you. This idea of geomantic recollection exists in many forms. In the Eastern form, the whole sense of the Tao is based on geomantic recollection, the idea that everything flows and that everything is in harmony, and that there are these primordial dualities, the yin and yang, underneath everything, and beneath that there is the great. Many people think of the Tao as a river. It's often considered to be like a river form, but one thing which is often forgotten is that the river is flowing in a bedrock of earth. And without this form of solidity, flow cannot manifest. In other words, there has to be the dynamic of flow and the dynamic of solidity. There has to be these two elements for there to be a dance. And this is what the Tao is really about. It is a dance between the yin and the yang, between the male and the female, this continual oscillation. And the only problems occur is when this gets frozen or stuck. That is the point of geomantic amnesia, right at the point where the dance gets stuck. And at the point it gets stuck, you are hypnotically fixated on all your objects, and you completely lose the view. Again, in terms of the Tibetan tradition, they call the view, the Tibetan term is tawa, and it means the view. And the view means the ability to see the absolute, the perfection, the already enlightened state, and at the same time to see and have compassion for the relative state in which we all exist. So the tawa really is to know that this perfected state, the dharmakaya, the void, the emptiness, whatever you want to call it, exists, and yet at the same time to have compassion for the relative state of all the confusion in which we exist. And once that is polarized until people just believing in the absolute and becoming fanatic about it, or just in the relative and becoming fanatic about it, again, this is where geomantic amnesia occurs, at these cutoff points, these freeze points. In the Western tradition, particularly in the context of, Anglo-Saxon magic, if you will, or shamanism, there is the tradition which is called the weird. And it's what we get the word, or W-E-I-R-D from, W-Y-R-R-D, the weird. The Anglo-Saxon word. And one of the meanings of this term is that everything is connected to everything else. The way that a bird flies across the forest can be read so that you will know what is happening in another point of the forest. When I first went to England, I know all these people were saying, well, there's one, there's a magpie. Or, okay, one, how does it go? One is for sorrow, two is for joy. And what's the rest of it? And then it goes off. But it's all this... Okay, and there's all this kind of reading of nature just by watching the birds. But it can be done by coffee grounds, it can be done by entrail reading. There are many, many ways of divination. So the weird is like the Tao in a sense. It's this total interdependent network. And what happens at sacred sites is that it is like a node for the weird. It's like a very important node where a lot of strands of the web come together. And at that point where it is easier for a person to become entrained with his environment, that is, where he is not different from his environment, he can totally communicate man to planet, planet to man, complete empathy to the point where there is no difference. In terms of a monument type 1 and monument type 2, monument type 1 deals with knowledge-based material. It deals with lots of data which doesn't really qualitatively change the way you see the world. Monument types 2 deal with what Gregory Bateson called real information. Real information is a difference that makes a difference. The other information is just difference, but it's difference that doesn't make any difference. It's quantitative. So the type of information that you will access at sacred sites is a difference that makes a difference. You see differently, you feel differently, you relate differently. So this is really very, very important. Now, how does geomantic amnesia occur on a practical level? Like, again, Professor Shah was talking about last night about doorways and lining beds and what you sleep over and things like that. And we'll talk a little bit more of that when we talk about the Dragon Project and we talk about things like geopathic zones and things like that. But for the moment, I'd like to pick something very, very simple that is missing from a lot of people's homes. Not everyone, but a lot of people's homes, which is a real example of geomantic amnesia. And that is a fireplace. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about what a fireplace is. First of all, in a home, it is called a hearth. And it represents the heart of the house. And it was the heart of the house because it was for cooking, and it was for warmth, it was for light, and it was for companionship. Now let's look at these things in a little bit more detail. Animals love it. These cats get entrained by flames. You just see them just sitting there and looking at it. People, if given half a chance to have an open fire. I mean, we have it right out here at night, people sitting around the fire. It entrains the mind. The flicker of the flames goes at about 5 to 7 cycles a second, which in brainwave terminology is right about on the alpha-theta border. This is where we get what we call flicker fusion. And this is where it acts as a reflective matrix. If you look at it, it can put you in a state of reverie. You all know the story of Kekule watching and the, you know, and getting this idea of the benzing ring of a snake with its tail in its mouth. He did that after dreaming in front of a fire. They will induce creative states of mind. It will induce calmness. 5 to 7 cycles a second will entrain you to be calm. It is a natural calmative in the home to have an open fire. If you have central heating or you have an electric fire, you have completely written out of your environment a natural calmative element. Even forget the inspirational element for a moment. You have written out a calmative matrix from your home. And finally, what else fires do is they tend to inculcate a sense of people telling stories to each other. This is so important because this is where people will trade the events of the day. And not only the events of the day, they will begin to become inspired to tell the mythological stories in front of a fire as well. So you get a complete magical exchange of information over a fire. Very different than if most people's meals average about 20 minutes or 15 minutes and it's over. And you don't get that sense that if you were sitting in front of a fire. So it's very, very important. Another sense of geomantic amnesia in context of the 20th century is what happens to space. I don't know how many of you do live in cities, but I would imagine a fair amount of you do. I mean, I've just come from London. When we live in densely packed space, what tends to happen is that it compresses the auric field around us. And as it compresses the auric field, that means that you are going to have a sense of temporal and spatial pressure on you. You can't even feel it. It's like when you walk down a street and there's people jostling you and bumping you and there's buildings all over. You get a feeling of kind of temporal and spatial compression. And it accelerates this idea of density of time very, very quickly. Now, an alternative to that is going out into nature. And that's why this foundation in the land is so beautiful for that. You go out into nature and what happens, it's what I call taking a space bath. You go out and you take a bath in space. And what happens then is that it completely takes off the temporal pressure and you can realign back to present time and the whole sense of geomantic recollection can be once again reintroduced into your life. That's what parks are about in cities. There are sanctuaries for you to go to reconnect, to get some even fragment of geomantic recollection in your daily life. So the temporal pressure and the spatial density increases one's sense of geomantic amnesia. Okay, just one or two last things here, and that is a little bit what we're going to look later on, what Paul and Nigel and I'll be talking about a little bit myself, when we're going to look at stone circles and stone monuments, megalithic sites. Mega is big, lithic is rocks, big stone monuments. Let's just take a very brief look at what is this quality of stone? What is stone all about? Stone has a property of, first of all, tremendous endurance. It will endure longer than wood and longer than any other, than plant material. It was the chosen element to build with in the ancient world, from the pyramids to the stone circles. What stones make us do, if we align with them properly, if we attune with them properly, if, to use, in a sense, Rupert's term of morphic resonance, if we allow ourselves to resonate with the stones, what the stones are telling us more than anything else is stillness. They are teaching us the value of stillness, of how to remain still, how to sit and how to receive, rather than just to go out and to take. Stones have this ability to put us in a state of contemplation by their very nature. That's why even in the Zen gardens, there are rock gardens in the center of monasteries. The stones, let's take the term, the Sanskrit term for a moment, samadhi. Samadhi means total collectedness. Mindfulness in the meditative path means the ability to recollect if you go off the path of concentration. If you are distracted, you have to recollect back to a still point. You always recollect back. But samadhi is when you have totally recollected to a point of stillness. And that's what the stones tell us, how to remain in a point of total stillness. The American Indians, for example, from the Sioux tradition, they say the stones and the minerals are placed in the ground by Wakantanka, some stones being more exposed than others. When a medicine man says that he talks with the sacred stones, it is because of all the substance in the ground, these are the ones which most often appear in dreams and are able to communicate with men. And so the stones have a very important function. Now, one more quick biblical reference here is that of Jacob sleeping on the pillar of stone. And when he did, he had this dream of the angels going up the ladder and down the ladder. In other words, the complete kind of, as it were, kind of Kabbalistic revelation. And the stone itself was called Beth-El. The stone was called Beth-El. Beth in Hebrew means house, and El is God. So Beth-El means house of God. But the important thing is that the stone was not God. It was the house. It was where God could manifest. And once you begin to make that transposition of the stone as God and then into idolatry, that's where the geomantic amnesia begins to set in as well. That the stone is a house of God. It allows him to manifest. But it itself is not the totality. Okay. Now, in summing up then, one of the things that I would like to see in an educational process in not only this country but just developed in the 20th century is a curriculum in which kids, and this stuff should start with kids so you don't have to go through 20 years of schooling and then de-school everyone with human potential movements and say, listen, you got it all wrong for 20 years and let's get it right now. If you start them out wrong, you get them wrong 20 years later. But if you start them out right, thinking ecologically, holistically, and if you introduce the idea of a cross-state retention to kids when they're young, the idea of what we call today general systems theory is another manifestation of this, that all things are related, not just you teach them reading, writing, arithmetic, history, and all things are separate, but you teach the relationships of all these things and how they integrate, you will get a completely new generation emerging. And you teach the senses. You teach amplified sensing in touch, taste, smelling, hearing, and sight. You have someone who is an expert in each of these sensory areas come and teach these things as they would have been taught in megalithic times. And you teach them all separately to begin with, and then you meld them. And you begin to get a synesthetic way of seeing the world so that all your senses meld and blend so that your seeing and your touch and your sight become cross-state. Perception then begins to develop. Not only cross-state retention, but cross-state perception. The way that you see then is much, much richer. You begin to see the environment in a totally different way. The way that Professor Shah walks around when he sees the environment is totally integrated. He sees the flow of energy, the shape of the land, the shape of the stone, the shape of the tree. Everything is put together. So we teach the idea of the patterns that connect, as Bateson would say. Now, one other thing about this this model here of if this is the cycle of the year, and these are equinoxes and solstices throughout the cycle of the year, the point is that these transitions, you see, the solstice is a point in which you go from the least light, and then the next day you begin to gain light. Or conversely, you go from the most light and then the next day you begin to lose light. These points, the solstice and equinoxes, are transition points from one state to another state. And it is why they are so important, because when one thing changes to another, this is the optimum time to facilitate cross-state retention. To remember that it is just at this point that we are changing from the dark to the light. And remember the state that we have come from and the state we are going to. Don't just forget it. Remember that we are going from one state to another. Again, in our 20th century model, our way of seeing, we have holidays which are largely based on giving gifts and having big meals. And we don't really understand this idea of contacting the great. And it is really, what I'm saying is at any point, any holiday, any holy day, is underneath its temporal nature of the year, you can use that as a vehicle to contact the great. And that is something that we should really never forget, because it is really the great, or what I call meanwhile back at the source, where it is all taking place, and what sacred places are really all about. That's all I want to say, and if you've got any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
One point stated something about ordinary consciousness. I was wondering, from your perspective, what do you view ordinary consciousness to be?
Ordinary consciousness is ego-based consciousness. Is when the mind is conceived as being separate from the rest of its environment, and everything is done for self-aggrandizement, the fears, the searches for anything are all based on an ego based way of seeing. And time with a little t is predominant then. It is what you do with time. Yeah.
A candle flame compared to
fire. A candle flame is excellent for a reflective matrix for meditation. Many of the great meditative traditions will use a candle flame. A candle flame can be used not only overtly by looking at it and using it as a point of fixation and as a point of calmness and stillness, but it can also be used after one shuts the eyes. One can then go into a completely different meditation at that point. Yeah?
What is the best way to connect with these solstice equinox times? Like, what will you be doing at this coming solstice? To get in with the crowd.
Well, for example, what is done in England, at least on the popular basis, is the Druids are always hauled out. And well, they aren't now. Nigel will tell us. We've had another chink in the geomantic amnesia going on in England at this point. What one can do, really, at one of these solstice or equinox points is really the following. Is get to a site which has been venerated for a long time as a sacred site. To take the day off, to be there at sunrise, okay? The most important points of the day are the two entry points, are sunrise and sunset. I'm glad you asked this question, because in a city environment in particular, the buildings take off the critical 5 to 10% of the horizon in which sunset and sunrise are seen. So this adds to the geomantic amnesia just by the obscuration of the skyline. So you want to place yourself in a point where you can actually see the sun coming up over the horizon, because then the majesty of the event becomes manifest even before then. You get this forelight coming, and then you get the event. So the timing is important, the sunrise and the sunset. These, in a sense, the sunrise and the sunset, are the points of transition in the day which are equivalent to the solstice and equinoctial points of the year. They are exactly that analogy. So being at a sacred site, A, being there at the right time, B, fasting would also encourage that state of mind. Also trying to understand, for example, if it's a solstice point, and let's say you're going from dark to light or light to dark, you would then meditate on which change that is going to be, if you're going into the light or you're going into the darkness. If you're going into the light, you still, via cross-state retention, say, okay, I'm going into the light, but I'm not going to forget this point of origin of this cycle. That is to say, the darkness seed of it. And if you're going vice versa, to remember it the other way. So these are some of the ways that I would go about it. And it's, you could do it with conjunction with other people or by oneself, either way. But distance, even if you can't get to an established site, like a stone circle or something like that, the world abounds with places of power that you can, places of vision overlooking a sea or a mountain, something like that, where you can find your own spot to do it.
It's probably one of the things to do if you do go to an ancient site is just to be aware and see what happened. Mm-hmm. Because specific things occur at the site. Sometimes a carved symbol on a stone can be framed by the sunlight. Sometimes a shadow is thrown. At midwinter sunrise at Newgrange, not only does the sunbeam go into the innermost chamber, but the outlying standing stones throw fingers of shadow onto the carved curved stones around. Mm-hmm. The most ancient carvings in Europe, and these fingers of shadow are pointing out things. So they still talk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a question of having eyes open as well, not just what you would do, but to be aware and receptive of places. It's how all the key of the sevens of your place in play have occurred.
That's right. It's this idea of just entering into present time with awareness of the sight and letting, as Paul was saying, letting it speak to you, letting yourself be filled by it. Yeah.
In speaking about the traditional sight, could you comment on, I guess, the balance or perspective on energy that has come from people being at these sites versus that which hasn't changed for centuries and centuries? And specifically, I would use two, since you brought up the stone, Stonehenge and Ayers Rock, Uluru, which are ones that are particularly noted both for their power and also for some of the disrespect in terms of the presence there.
Right. That is a very good question. And we can begin by talking about the whole concept of what is known as evolved sites. That is to say, a site was built, let's say, 3000 B.C., okay, what begins to happen is after the original inhabitants and culture goes, another cultural wave comes in and begins to look at this site, and they may not have the direct transmission of what this site was originally based for. So they begin to use it for their own purposes, and it might be completely different. An example of this, not to the ones that you mentioned, I'll talk about those in a second, where we're working at Wallwright Stone Circle in Oxfordshire in England on the Dragon Project. It has a tremendous history of witchcraft based on it. Not only witchcraft, but mutilation and sacrifice and even ritual murder based on it from later times than it was originally built for. So you have this aura of the original kind of majesty and sanctity of the site, which Ayers Rock and Stonehenge would have as well. And then you get this historical overlay of what happens with the people perverting it and misusing it. And you get people coming into the site who are sensitive. I brought in a number of psychics to places like Wallwright, and the things that they pick up on, some of these psychics that I bring are so into being psychics that they feel that I'm too sensitive. It's too many bad things have happened to you. I've got a headache. I can't take it. You know, and they can't handle it because they get stuck on all this kind of patina of overlay of the perversion level. And to get down to the great level takes a much deeper time that you have to spend in a place like this. At Stonehenge now it's impossible because Stonehenge is cordoned off. Occasionally you can get into the central place of it, but it's cordoned off. They were talking for a while of building a fiberglass model of Stonehenge and letting people walk around that and painting it. Okay, but it wouldn't have made any difference. For all intents and purposes now, Stonehenge has already been desacralized in a certain sense because there's the parking lot and the Coca-Cola and the tickets and the stuff like flowing down. You cannot enter into the sacred dimension once you begin to charge admission and create a... It's gone. The magic of it is gone. Ayers Rock is... I haven't been there, but so I don't know the dimension of its desacralization. But any place that tourists come to that is... You see, the thing is, for a place to remain its sanctity... It's like Professor Shaw hit it on the nail last night. He said the monasteries that have lasted the longest are the ones that are most inaccessible. They're the ones in the highest mountains. They're the ones that you've got to take a horseback or you've got to walk to. And anything which has easy accessibility to it will not have that enduring sense of sacredness. It's just because people will come to it. I don't know if I've touched on some of the things that you were saying. Do you want to raise anything else on that?
Yeah, I did.
Sure.
When you say it's gone, what do you mean by that exactly?
Okay. It's only gone to the extent that if a decision was made by some enlightened government to completely take away the tourist aspects of a place, that is to say, to take away, this is Stonehenge and it was 4000 BC and you must see it and every tour must go here. The place still inherently has much of its geomantic power. Much of it, not all of it, because again, as Professor Shah said last night, the earth is continually changing and manifesting. But if you take away the barbed wire fences and all the kind of trappings of the tourism, a lot of the original can come to life again. But it can't. But the idea that it's in people's minds, even so, means that they're still going to come to it and abuse it.
Okay, and could you just place that then in juxtaposition to both the changing of the earth and the emergence of what we might refer to as new sight, and the presence or use of energy in these places in a way that brings that sacredness juxtaposed to what you just described?
Right, when you say by new sight, you mean new sacred signs.
Yeah.
Okay, well this is again a very important point, because a lot of us get roped into the idea that because everything was built 5,000 years ago and all these sacred sites, we have to keep to these sacred sites for all time and that's it. And I agree that this is tremendously important for a sense of, again, morphic resonance and a traditional recollection and power. But every age, I also believe, should have the ability to find and create its own sacred site, and therefore getting away from this kind of hackneyed tourist bus thing coming to this site which has been for thousands of years. So I think that the creation of new sacred sites, and this can be done, again, by proper geomancy. And that's what he was saying last night. You select the right site. We can build a monastery here, which in 3 years will have the juice behind it. So the world, the earth, holds many, many potential sacred sites. It just takes the right vision, and then you begin to, first of all, you have to make them inaccessible so that you're not going to get flocks and flocks of people coming. And then you begin to develop your aboriginal traditions and whatever new traditions you want to develop as well. But the site has to be difficult to get to. There has to be some degree of sacrifice for you getting to that site. Right now, the reason why these sites are desacralized is because you just get off the tour bus and there's no sacrifice on your part in order to enter into the space of these things. It's too easy. Okay. Joan?
I just wanted to sort of three things. One would be caves as sacred places, because caves breathe. And my take on this idea of the change of earthly position is that wouldn't affect with breathing cave dynamics. Therefore, perhaps caves would always be sacred in a sense, always breathing. And the earthly position cannot, you know, alter that. Other things can, like earthquakes,
blocking. Yeah, yes, sure.
But that was one thing. Two other things. One is in your circle there, you have these four X's and four zeros. And I was wondering, is there four solstices and four equinoxes?
No, I just put there cross quarter days as well.
Well, this is interesting to me, because the Native Americans, many traditions, talk about four sacred mountains.
Mm-hmm.
The mountains are placed at these alternate points, not at the not directly north, north, south, east, west,
right.
But in those intermediate
right.
points, I guess you're locating at zero.
That's right.
And I was wondering if you could comment on that, and then I had one other thing to say. That those alternate points, I guess.
Well, I can say a little bit about them, and I'm sure that, for example, Nigel can say quite a bit more about them. But on your, for example, some of the cross quarter points, for example. There's one that happens, let's take one near, say, Halloween. You get a situation which is, for example, the end of the planting year.
Can you say what they are?
Okay, let's see. Nigel, you can correct me on this. You get Lammas, Candlelammas, Michaelmas, what is it?
So you've got Lammas, which is always the first.
Okay.
You've got Michaelmas, which is the same as Halloween. It's
right.
The same. It's November
okay.
1st. And then Candlemas, which is the in bulk Brigantia, which is February the 1st.
Right.
And then May Day, Beltane.
Right, exactly.
May Eve, all that.
Right. And what do you want? Do you want to say a little bit about each one?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to do a bit more on this, later on.
Okay, just a little bit about each one.
Well, I mean, it's all to do with the cycles of the seasons. These points are traditional points between the equinoxes and the solstices. They're not actually directly intermediate, because they are related to a date in the calendar,
right.
So things have changed. The cycles of the sun precession of the equinoxes has altered it. But effectively, they have relationships to, for instance, Candlemas, the first one in the year, if you take it as generally first starting the year, is the beginning of the seed in the ground beginning to germinate, and it's just the very first signs that the winter is getting over, or the winter is not going to be permanent. And then you get the next thing is the spring equinox, which is where you go from the dark half to the light half of the year. Then you get May Day, Beltane, which is the beginning of summer. And of course these things are of Northern European origin, and so they relate to the seasons in north of Europe rather than to say seasons here or in other parts of the world, so they are specific to a kind of weather system. Then from there on you go to the midsummer, which is the highest point of the sun in the year, as well as being the longest day. So the height of the sun relates to the length of the day. And of course north of the Arctic Circle it's sun due north at midnight as well. You can actually see the sun. I've got a slide of the descent of it, and it's a very important day in the pagan tradition, as attested by the Stonehenge Druids and also the Icelandic and northern tradition of hailing the sun due north. Then the next one you have is Lammas, which comes from the Anglo-Saxon loaf mass, and it is the decline of the year. It's the first corn being cut. This is harvest festival in the Christian tradition, is related to it, but it's an older tradition, of course, but of course the Christian tradition is based upon the cycles of the season like any other.
Was that August 1st?
August 1st, yeah. Then you've got the autumnal equinox, which is the transition between the light half and the dark half of the year. And of course at the equinoxes it's sun due east at sunrise and sunset. And also right the way through the year, the sunrises and sunsets on opposite sides of the year are opposite one another. This is another geometrical feature. I'll go into that later on. Then what we have? Yeah, midwinter. We're just going over the other. We got to Halloween. Well, I mean, Halloween's important because it's the beginning of the Celtic New Year, or the festival of the dead. And in the Christian tradition, it's All Saints, and that's supposed to be in the Celtic tradition, the point at which the walls are thinnest and it's most easy to access the spirits of the dead. And so the past and the future are accessed at that point. And so you have the idea of the ghosts and the spirits around, and also the idea of being able to tell what's coming in the coming year by doing various things, which are now games, but like many things such as board games, they've been devalued from their real spiritual and divinatory function into being entertainment. And we went round, didn't we?
Yeah,
we got
around
midwinter. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Nigel. Any other questions on this? Yeah.
Yes, in your work, John, have you come across anything that could be represented genetic memory?
What are you driving at?
As far as common reincarnation, people who would remember, have recollections, maybe it's that chard of memory that we see in there that might relate to any the genetic line.
Do you mean in terms of? I'm still trying to get how you're looking at it from, and how a person might have past life memory.
Past life memory tied in with different periods of time and place.
Oh, okay. Well, the only thing that I would just say a little bit about that is from the point of view of memory is that wherever an activity takes place in the environment, there will be an encoding of that activity in the chi, in the subtle nature of that environment. This is why, for example, people can go into rooms of a house and they can say, oh, gee, that room gives me the creeps. I'm not staying in there. It's because, it's like he was saying last night, there has been a murder in the house or a ghost in the house. And some people are real sensitive to that. Place holds a memory. Now, if you come to a place in which, let's just say, for example, that you were in some battle or something and you died in some battle, and let's say you revisit that place, again, it's almost like the morphic resonance again. It can spark off that memory of your past life because of the place that you are in holds that memory, and there is a resonance between genetically, or I don't even know what the term to call it is,
psychometry.
Yeah, well, that is. Yeah, that's the term used, psychometry. It's the ability to read the memory field of an object. But I think that place memory can stimulate past life memory. But you have to be pretty predisposed to it to occur in a non-random manner. I mean, most of the times it happens in places of tragedy, where something really has imprinted of a negative, violent nature. But if you are into the idea of going to places of sacred places, that's why people make pilgrimages to sacred places now, to see if they can't, if their own memory can't be, can't be triggered off by the place memory itself.
For better visualization, because that was one of the terms I wanted to use for people who are familiar with psychometry and so forth, is viewing a lot of objects much the way as you would a cassette tape to a cassette recorder. And we may very well be, or we are that device to tune into certain things on whatever level. Now, your question was that in regard to RNA and DNA factors of growth. I think that's a possible variable, but it's, again, it's a very, you know, involved thing, and a very complex matrix to put all of this together, you know, in a simple term.